Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 7th of January 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because this is one of the live shows that we do and I do have with me my co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community and I believe it's .org. What is it? Patrioticarts.community. That's the one. Patriarch, how are you doing today? Anyway, did you have a good Christmas and Happy New Year to you, sir?
Hi, Sven. Yes, it's good to be back. Christmas was good. Nothing too crazy went off, but just catching up with family, friends, and pretty much that's what it's about for me nowadays. First official Christmas with the wife, and then New Year, just saw an old friend, not seen in a while, and just pretty casual. How about yourself?
Yes, very good. I had visitors over here, and I actually stayed in most of the time with some guests that I had staying. I actually stayed in on New Year's Eve for the first time in quite a few years. Normally, I go around and see the neighbours, but it was nice Christmas. Nice to take some time off, a couple of weeks off. We pre-recorded podcasts, as you yourself know. This is the first one that we've actually made together for probably about 3 weeks, I think. And just into the new year, just as the new year started, I was just setting up for Patriotic Weekly Review to do the simulcasting with the live streaming on Wednesday. And a good friend of Radio Albion and a good friend of myself, Hallandere, came into the chat and he said, did I know that there was an advert for radioalbion.com at the beginning of Sam Hyde's podcast? And I was like, no, I didn't know anything about this. And I used to really enjoy watching Sam Hyde with a Million Dollar Extreme. It was actually through Sam Hyde I discovered Scott Storm King, a fantastic synthwave artist who seems to have disappeared. He was going by the name of Tequila Mockingbird back then. But Sam Hyde has a new podcast out, and at the front of it, at the beginning, it says Executive Producers, and it says NoWhiteGuilt.org, and it says RadioAlbion.com, and some very, very kind person, very generous person, has paid out a lot of money to have us listed as the executive producers on this podcast. So they're helping us out. Well, they're helping RadioAlbion.com out, and they're also helping NoWhiteGuilt.org out. They're also helping our good friend Jason Coney out by advertising us to Sam Hyde's viewers. Sam Hyde's viewers are all alternative types, nationalist types anyway, so that's our target audience. And the money has obviously helped Sam Hyde out to make the podcast. I mean, fantastic. Talk about killing two birds with one stone. And then today in the chat room, the blessed madman, as Hallandere referred to him as, has identified himself as Tall Kevin 87 on Instagram. So any of our listeners that are on Instagram, do go and give Tall Kevin 87 a follow on there. And we are really grateful to you, Kevin, for shelling out that money for us and advertising us in such a way. We really appreciate it. And that was a fantastic start to the new year. So thank you very much for that from the bottom of my heart. And I know Jason is just as grateful as I am. So thank you. You're a very kind soul doing that for us. Do you have any comments on that, Patriarch? Do you watch Sam Hyde at all?
Yeah, I've seen a number of his clips. He's quite a funny guy. Definitely not of the woke spectrum, that's for sure. So yeah, he's a funny guy. Raises a few smiles.
Yeah, right-wing comedian. I say I haven't watched anything of his recently, I guess. I guess I should do, since I'm an executive producer now for his new podcast. But getting on to the subject matter for tonight, we're going to continue talking about the Phoenicians tonight. In the last episode, we finished up by taking a look at the Phoenicians, and we established that the Golden Age of Phoenicia began when the tribes of Israel kicked the Canaanites out from that area and then moved in themselves. And we showed that many of the names associated with Phoenicia are also the names of Israelite tribes like Gad and Dan. And we finished up by talking about their alphabet, which is the oldest known alphabet in the world. And we are going to start today's episode by looking at how that came about. And I'll just go back a little bit there when I was talking about the names of the Israelite tribes. You've got Dan in the Danube, Danyester, Danyepa, Danmark. You've got the tribe of Dan, the Twatted of Dan in Ireland. This word Dan pops up everywhere, and Gad does as well. You talk about gadding about, and one of the names for them was Gad. Sorry, go on, Patriarch.
There's Swedan as well, isn't there?
Swedan, yes, that pops up in there as well. And we basically showed that these names for these Israelite tribes just appear in all these names for various places, and particularly rivers. But today we want to talk a little bit about the alphabet at first, because the Phoenician alphabet was the first proper alphabet. It's actually where we get the term phonetic from, for the way that we write. And we can see that the previous ways of writing that we looked at, cuneiform and hieroglyphs, and they were symbols for words itself. Whereas what the Phoenicians did, they had symbols for letters in the way that we speak. So it was a completely different way of writing an alphabet, and their alphabet was the very first alphabet. And all the other alphabets can be seen to be derived from this Phoenician script. And runes also go back to this time. And we can see that Proto-Phoenician has much in common with the runes. And Proto-Phoenician is exactly the same as early Hebrew. That was early Hebrew. The Hebrews, the Israelites, wrote in the same language that the early Phoenicians did. Do you want to add anything to that, Patriarch?
I knew they were very similar. I didn't realize that the phonetic, Paleo-Phoenician alphabet was the oldest. I didn't realize that was the case. I thought it was Paleo-Hebrew, and then out of that came the ancient Phoenician alphabet.
It's the same thing. The Phoenicians were the Hebrews. When we get to the golden age of Phoenicia, that was when the Canaanites were all kicked out. There wasn't Phoenician alphabet until that time.
So what are the main distinctions then for the change of label, so to speak, just because of the cultural shift?
Well, it was a completely different way of writing things, because you're actually having a symbol for a sound rather than a symbol for an object, if you see what I mean.
No, I see what you're saying. I guess where it separated itself from Paleo-Hebrew, you know what?
Well, Paleo-Hebrew is the same as Phoenician. It's pretty much the same. It's pretty much the same thing. When you look at Paleo-Hebrew, which came about like slightly later on than the earliest Phoenician alphabet we have, we end up with stuff that's written, and it's obviously Hebrew things that are written. It's sections from the Old Testament that we see written in that way. We don't have much of it, but we do have sections of the Old Testament written in various places in this style, which is called Paleo-Hebrew, which is exactly the same as Phoenician. So it's another proof that the Phoenicians were the Israelites. And we'll get to some of these examples here as well. But I was looking at it today, and you can really clearly see, like, English letters, like the word A is the same as the Aleph, which is the bull, which you can see the symbol in Phoenician, and you can see that there's a similarity to it right the way through, even in the Egyptian hieroglyphs. This bull was one of the first ones, the A. And if you look at our A shape, it's upside down. The horns are pointing downwards, and the face is upwards with our A.
I think there was a distinction as well in terms of reading left to right as opposed to right to left.
Yes, that's changed over the years as well.
Yeah. I think we mentioned as well in one previous podcast that they might have had something to do with the Western and Eastern Hemisphere from the center of the world, you know, the center of civilization.
Well, yeah, the center of everything has been that Fertile Crescent, and particularly that little spot where Israel is. I mean, that's where all the trade routes cross. It's a very important part of the world. Always has been, because of that point. It's the central point of the world, basically, and where all the paths cross if you want to get from east to west. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to read from Tracing Our Ancestors by Frederick Haberman, and I've read from him before, and this is a bit about the alphabet here. At the end of chapter 2, I have quoted from Chambers' encyclopedia regarding the fact that the roots of most of our languages can be traced to the Aryan parent stock, which had its home in Central Asia. From the same encyclopedia, I quote here a paragraph from its article, Alphabet. To a French scholar, Monsieur de Rouge belongs the honour of having demonstrated the true origin of the alphabet. Several classical writers, including Plato, Diodorus, Plutarch, and Tacitus, had stated in general terms the belief or tradition of the ancient world that the Phoenicians had obtained the alphabet from Egypt, while in modern times not a few attempts had been vainly made to derive the several Phoenician letters from suitable hieroglyphic pictures. But it was only in 1859 that de Rouge pointed out that the prototypes of the Phoenician letters must be sought not in the hieroglyphics of the monuments, but in certain cursive, hieratic, or priestly characters so extremely ancient that they had fallen into disuse at the time of the Hebrew Exodus. This form of hieratic writing is known to us almost exclusively from a single manuscript, the Papyrus Prissi, as it is called, which was found in a tomb belonging to the 11th dynasty and is therefore much older than the Shepherd Kings. So I think this gives us a clue as to where the Hebrews actually got this from. It was made up from the priestly writing that was actually in Egypt. And as we've talked about before, these priests, they were from Shem, the original ones that built the pyramid and stayed there, and that's why the Pharaoh was kind to Joseph and found him a wife. It's because there were these Hebrews there and these Hebrew priests. So this writing, this hieratic script, that got changed into what became known as Phoenician by the Hebrews. And Moses was translating the tablets into this script, and that's where our Old Testament actually came from. So that's a little bit pointing to that. We've got a bit here about Professor L.A. Waddell as well. On page 5 of his Aryan Origin of the Alphabet, he refers to Sir Philinders Petri, who found in the royal tombs of Menes and his first dynasty at Abydos characters of the so-called Phoenician alphabet. This discovery proves first that the Egyptian hieroglyphic characters developed later than the Phoenician, and second, that the kings of the first Egyptian dynasties were of the Aryan race. It is possible, therefore, that in those early Phoenician characters, we have the original alphabet developed by Enoch and given to him by divine inspiration, because the legends tell us that the original alphabet, original writing, was given to Enoch, the guy, Noah's father, I think it was, Noah's grandfather, who lived for 900 years or something similar. Was it 356? I don't know. He lived for a long time, and apparently he went up to heaven whole. He didn't die. He just went up to heaven whilst he was still alive. And then it has a comparative table here. Plate number 5 gives us a comparative table of the Phoenician, Greek, Hebrew, and Latin alphabets taken from Chambers' encyclopedia. It is evident from this table that both the Greek and the Latin are derived from the Phoenician. The Hebrew characters have been developed since the time of Christ, and that's when we get to the square-shaped so-called Hebrew writing that we have today, which we see today. And Hebrew was the language of the Jews, which the latter developed in Babylonian captivity. So the Hebrew language that we see today was developed by the Jews later on, or the Judeans when they were in Babylonian captivity, and then was carried on by the Jews when they went back to Judea. Before that, Israel spoke the Phoenician dialect and wrote the much simpler Phoenician characters. And you can see on this table the origins of the alphabet there. And also, when they link back the origin of writing to Enoch is also linked with Thoth from Egypt, who was supposed to be the originator of writing, and almost also Hermes Trismegistus. There's certain parts of each one of these characters, certain symbols that they use that link them together as being one character. So even when you read research in Egypt and it says that Thoth was the father of letters and what have you, you find that there is some imagery associated with Thoth that is also associated with Enoch, who legend tells us was the first to come out with this writing. So then it became developed by the Hebrew priests that were in Egypt, and then it was developed some more by Moses. And then by the time we get to David and Solomon and the Phoenician Empire, it's in common use. And then from there, it became Greek, it became Latin, and it became the English alphabet that we have today.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting how it all connects back. There's a research paper I did once where I was looking at the timing of the 5th century BC when the Paleo Hebrew was kind of adopted and started to change, and that pretty much kind of correlates with when the northern tribes were dispersed, and there would have been a very small percentage of original Israelites in that kind of area around 500 BC. So I think it kind of helps us understand a bit more how and why it changed, because it's clearly the culture was just taken into the hands and carried forward by a different people.
Well, they lost their land, didn't they? And they were removed to Babylon. I've actually got a quote here, which is from Wikipedia about this. By the 5th century BC, amongst the Judeans, the Paleo-Hebrew alphabet had mostly been replaced by the Aramaic alphabet, which was the official one used in the Persian Empire, which, like all alphabetical writing systems, was itself ultimately a descendant of the Phoenician script. The Jewish square script variant, which is in use by Jews today, is also inaccurately referred to as the Hebrew alphabet. This evolved directly out of the Aramaic script around the 3rd century BC, although some of the letter shapes did not become standard until the 1st century AD. So it says there that they had this original Phoenician alphabet. When they got removed out of Judea, they started using Aramaic, which came with the Persian Empire. And then from that Aramaic, you then get the Jewish square script, which we have now. And the New Testament, some of that was written in Aramaic. Aramaic and Greek were the two languages in use at the time of the New Testament. And they're both descended from Phoenician or Paleo-Hebrew. I mean, you can use those two terms pretty much interchangeably.
Yeah, it's interesting. But I said Aramaic, as it is today, is where you get the, the stereotypical sort of Arabic type writing, where it's very curvy and it just looks like a far removed culture, doesn't it?
Well, that's what it evolved into with the Arabs. It evolved into the Arabic writing from the Aramaic. I mean, Aramaic was used by white people as well as non-white people, and then you get to Arabic, which was just used by non-white people, basically. Right, okay. And it changed over the years. And the really interesting thing is when you compare Nordic runes to Paleo-Hebrew, and it's pretty much exactly the same. If you look at the word Yahweh written in Paleo-Hebrew, I mean, it's just made out of Nordic runes. And you can quite clearly see that's where the Nordic runes came from. They came from this as well.
Well, yeah, exactly. And if some people say, oh, well, it's a massive coincidence, well, you have to say, well, how is that connection possible? How is it even there? You know, how, were these people interconnected? If they're not going to accept that they're racially kindred, then, you know, they need to at least explain how there's a cultural tie there as well.
Well, once you understand that Phoenicia was Israel, it was Israelites there, tribes of Israel that were in Phoenicia, and you understand that the Phoenician Empire was the great trading empire that took in all the Mediterranean and Europe, and as we'll see in a minute here, it also stretched as far as America. then you can understand that's where this came from. That's where all these connections came from. And you can't argue against the Phoenicians being the Israelites, because they took over Sidon and Tyre, which was the center of Phoenicia. And that's when we read about all these exploits of the Phoenicians. And there's they were pagan then as well, as we'll see. There's quite a lot for us to get into here. The Phoenicians built Carthage in North Africa, which is now called Tunisia, and they ruled the ocean, preventing anyone else from going any further than the Pillars of Hercules. They themselves are reputed to have got as far as America, and traces of their writing have been found there, along with the remains of their mining. They would have brought slaves with them from Africa, and this is likely the origin of the Negroid-looking features on some of the statuary of the South American Indians. The Phoenicians themselves are likely where the red hair and blue eyes among the natives came from that the first European explorers noted among them. With the collapse of the Near Eastern Empire, missions as far abroad as America ceased, and no actual settlements are recorded as being made there. And I was looking through another book today about this, and it looks like the Celts were over in America as well. So you had Phoenicians, Celts, and Vikings before Columbus got there. And the proof of that is the writing that's left there. There's actually Ogham writing, which is the writing that is native to Ireland, and that's found in America. And you've also got Phoenician writing that he's found there. And then we've got the legends of the Vikings going there. So it wasn't just the Phoenicians that left red hair and blue eyes. It would have been the Celts and the Vikings as well, which explains why the Columbus and the explorers of Columbus time, that's why they discovered that there in amongst the natives.
So they were the Celts come from the which line in particular? The Gauls.
Yeah, the Gauls, the Galatians, the Belgic tribes, and the tribes that were in Britain. I think we can call all the pretty much all the tribes that weren't the Saxons and the Germanic tribes, but that were in Gaul and Britain in that area. We can pretty much say that they were Celts, and they stretched up to the Mediterranean, to the Galatia. Where we get the Galatians from.
Much of them originated or crossed the Caucasus, right?
Yeah, this is the other thing. I mean, they are the same people as the Germans, but back then you had the Cimmerians and the Scythians, and the Scythians turned into the Saxons, the Cimmerians turned into the Celts, and originally they were the same people, and they were these Israelite tribes that were removed from Israel to the buffer zone above Assyria, between Assyria and I think the place is called Urartu. And then the Book of Esdras tells us that they went up through the Straits of the Euphrates and headed off into Europe. And by the time we get to Flavius Josephus, he tells us that the number of these Israelite tribes that are in Europe is beyond number. You cannot number them. There are that many of them that are there, now there. And before that, the historians tell us there weren't that many people in Europe. They were just on the coastlands. Mm-hmm. So the big migration wave took place really sort of between the 5th century BC and later. But before that, there have been two other waves that came in. And I actually did a Daily Nationalist on this the other day. There was new evidence that came in about the origins of the Celts and how there were these three migrations into Britain, and the study's authors were really surprised that there were these connections going to Central Europe from Britain. And I'm thinking, well, we know that there were connections going from Britain all the way to the Near East and the Fertile Crescent. Where else did they get their tin from to make the Bronze Age? And yet these authors were stunned just to discover that Britain was connected to Central Europe, let alone further. But they're getting there. They're a bit behind us, but they'll eventually get there, I hope. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, and if they're allowed to get there, I mean, most mainstream historians will just kind of walk the line, won't they, what they're allowed to say?
Yeah, they know that they'll lose their grants if they wander off the reservation too far. Well, again, I've got some more quotes here, and this is with reference to the Phoenicians in America. It's from a book called Israel's Lost Empires by Stephen M. Collins. And he actually starts talking about the mound builders of ancient America. And you know, we have these mounds in Britain, Silbury Hill and other places. And we look at them, they're like tumuli. We didn't talk that much about tumuli when we talked about the megaliths, but they're like earthen mounds, basically. Well, they've got these in America as well. As I say, this is Stephen M. Collins. He says, how large and viable was the early Hebrew Phoenician civilization in the New World? Evidence now exists that it was expansive and long-lived. The following passage is taken from the Edina Tablets, written by Robert Lenhart and published in the Epigraphic Society Occasional Publications, Volume 13, 1985. And he says, when the first settlers moved westwards from the American colonies, they discovered the great burial mounds and earthworks of the Ohio Valley. The mounds were obviously the work of man, but not within the capacity or tribal memories of the tribes who inhabited the valley at that time. Presidents Thomas Jefferson and William Henry Harrison, scientists, many eminent clergymen, and others speculated that the mounds and earthworks were built either by Egyptians, Norsemen, or the lost tribes of Israel. Concerning this early Edina civilization, Lenhart also states that they reached a very high cultural level over 1500 years and then disappeared about 500 AD. The Edina people dominated the Ohio Valley from about 1000 BC. The Edina people and their offshoot, the Hopewell culture, and there's a picture of the Chillicothe, Ohio mounds, which do look similar to the British ones. The Hopewell culture were the first of the North American mound builders who constructed impressive burial mounds that have survived to the present. The Encyclopedia Americana also traces the earliest mound builders in ancient America to 1000 BC. The mound builders had an impressive civilization. And remember, 1000 BC is about the time of Solomon and David. The Americana comments as follows. Whites who settled west of the Appalachians were so impressed by the number and size of these earthworks that they imagined a super race of mound builders antedating the Indians. It also describes the Edina earthwork mounds as follows. The Edina people buried their dead in large conical mounds of earth, together with rich grave goods of copper, mica, and stone, and they left many ornaments and pieces of jewellery, as well as stone tablets covered with curvilinear designs. This is an interesting term here. The term curvilinear designs is actually a euphemistic phrase describing old world inscriptions. Alphabetic writing involves curved lines written in a linear manner. Therefore, curvilinear designs should more accurately have been written ancient inscriptions. Dr. Barry Fell, in his book Saga America, discussed these curvilinear designs. The so-called curvilinear is, in fact, writing. Ancient Punic, and Punic is just the word for the Phoenician civilization that was in North Africa. You've got, when they talk about Phoenicia, most people are talking about Syria and the Levant. And when they talk about Punic, they're talking about Carthage and North Africa. But it is the same people, as we'll see when we discuss Carthage. That was a colony of the Phoenicians. So the so-called curvilinear is in fact writing ancient Punic, Greek, and Libyan Arabic of North Africa. And by Libyan Arabic, I guess they're talking about of Cyrenaica, what is now called Libya, that again, it used to be a Punic colony, using alphabets that are proper to those tongues. Similar texts, including also Celtic, Iberian, and Hebrew, were inscribed in other parts of America. The Edina people flourished in the American Midwest, as noted, beginning around 1000 BC. Examples of their megaliths are the Newark mounds. Their arrival in ancient America was part of the expansionary phase of ancient Israel under the kings David and Solomon around 1000 BC, as the Phoenician Empire grew very powerful. Let us examine what languages have been found on artifacts in these ancient American burial mounds. In 1838, a tablet, skeleton, and copper arm ring were excavated in Grave Creek, West Virginia, from an Edina burial mound site. Concerning this tablet, Dr. Barry Fell wrote, "It was at once recognized by Professor Raffin of Copenhagen as being Iberian. The language of the tablet is Punic, written in the form of alphabet used in Spain during the first millennium BC. It may be translated reading from right to left. The mound raised on high for Taysak, this tile his queen caused to be made. The alphabet of the tablet was deciphered by Spanish scholars and published by the English epigrapher D. Dieringer in 1968. The language is basic Semitic, and all words occur in standard literary Semitic dictionaries. Another excavated tablet found in a different burial mound in West Virginia was inscribed in Iberian script and employing the Punic language. It shares some of its vocabulary and all of its basic style characters with the historic tablet of Taysak excavated in 1838 in West Virginia. Its vocabulary is found in standard Semitic dictionaries and yields the following translation: the memorial of Teth, this tile his brother caused to be made. And of course, when they're talking about Semitic, they're talking about the language that was used by the Shemites back then. Now, obviously, it is mainly used to describe today's modern Jews. But as we showed with the alphabet here, the modern Jewish Hebrew, which they use today, goes back to this old Phoenician, which goes back to white people before the Jews became Edomites. But it's still Semitic. That's what you would refer to it as. Do you want to add anything to that, Patriarch?
No, I'm good.
Okay. The presence of Iberian Punic inscriptions on these tablets indicates their makers had their origins in the Phoenician colony in ancient Iberia. That the Edina people buried their dead with Semitic inscriptions of the Hebrew-Phoenician language group confirms that the Edina people were a large colony of Shemitic settlers from the Old World. Given the proximity of these finds to the Decalogue tablet found in Ohio and inscribed with the Ten Commandments in ancient Hebrew, it seems evident that ancient America was inhabited for many centuries by Israelite settlers. And the Decalogue tablet is quite a famous one, and that is written in Paleo-Hebrew. And they found this before they had evidence of Paleo-Hebrew, before archaeologists had dug it up in the Near East. They actually found this tablet in Ohio that had the Ten Commandments on it written in Paleo-Hebrew.
Wow.
Though Israel ceased to be a nation in the 8th century BC, its American colony outlived its parent nation for many centuries, linked to its sister Phoenician colonies in Carthage, Iberia, and Britain. It is significant that the Edina civilization began around 1000 BC. The first book in this series documented that the Lake Superior copper mines were apparently worked to exhaustion around 1000 BC when King David was importing massive amounts of copper ore into Israel. It seems evident that the Israelites, together with their Tyrian and Sidonian allies, founded the Edina colonies to exploit the natural resources of ancient North America. A Michigan author, Betty Sodders, wrote the following about the widespread utilization of ancient America's natural resources by these people. Michigan was the copper mining center of the New World. Still, other prehistoric diggings for various minerals became clearly evident across our entire nation. Mica was mined in North Carolina, serpentine in Pennsylvania, and lead mines were found in Kentucky, just to name a few. The most baffling endeavor was located along the Mississippi Valley, where prehistoric oil wells were actually discovered. Additional oil operations can be noted in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Canada. Did your history text teach you that a sophisticated ancient civilization with Shemitic inscriptions in their graves built elaborate mounds and mined the mineral wealth of ancient America? Probably not. Yeah.
No, not quite.
Unfortunately, the truth about ancient America's links with old world civilizations has not been taught in America's schools. The truth would be fascinating. However, if the truth were widely told, the Bible's historical accounts would be given dramatic new credibility, and the theory of evolution would be given a mortal blow. Therein lies the most likely explanation for the truth being withheld from the American people. The Grave Creek Mound tablets date to approximately 300 to 200 BC, a time when North American Shemites were linked to Punic cultures in Spain and Carthage. Since it is apparent that the late Adena civilization was a Shemitic culture, like those in Iberia and North Africa, sharing a common culture and language, it is evident that these groups shared a common origin, and that common origin was the Phoenician alliance of Israel, Tyre, and Sidon. And I'll just stop there again, because they were all Israelites in each one of those places, but they were city-states in their own right. So you had the city-state of Tyre, the city-state of Sidon, city-state of Israel, mm-hmm. all in that same area. It is significant that an ancient Adena personage interred in an American burial mound was named Tasach. God promised Abraham that through Isaac, which is Isach, shall your descendants be named. God promised that Isaac's name would be an identifying marker for locating the birthright descendants of Abraham, and the name Tasach, found in ancient America, is derived from the name Isaac. Tasach must have been a prominent Israelite in the ancient colony in North America to warrant such a burial mound. Also, the Decalogue tablet found in an Ohio burial mound indicates that it was the final resting place of an ancient Levite or priest, because the Levites and the priests were the custodians and the teachers of the laws of God. And again, I'll just stop there. Do you want to make any comments on that at all, or what we've done so far, Patriarch?
No, it's all new to me at the moment, these finer details.
Yeah, it's rare that you find this information about these links to America. I mean, a lot of people know about the Israelite tribes making their way into Europe and the history that surrounds that, but the links with the earlier ancient empires in America is not something that gets talked about that much. The Phoenicians also explored South America. This is not surprising, because South America's shores are closer than North America to Phoenician colonies in Iberia and Carthage. In 1872, a stone with a Phoenician inscription was found in Brazil that describes an expedition of Sidonians who practiced human sacrifice and appealed to Baal and other gods and goddesses. It states its Sidonian makers were part of a 10-ship expedition sent in the 19th year of King Hiram's reign from the port of Ezion Geber in the Red Sea, and that they arrived in the island of Iron after a 2-year voyage around Africa. These facts are based on a translation by Dr. Kyrus Gordon in his book Before Columbus. Others have doubted the authenticity of the inscription. But Dr. Gordon outlined reasons why the inscription is authentic. One is that these ancient sailors referred to themselves as Sidonians, not Phoenicians. This is consistent with the factual reality that they would not have referred to themselves as Phoenicians, the name the Greeks used for them. At first glance, the reader may be tempted to think this inscription dates to the King Hiram, who was contemporaneous with Kings David and Solomon. However, there are strong reasons to think otherwise. One is a reference to the practice of human sacrifice by this group of Sidonians. Kings David and Solomon would never have tolerated such a practice in their navies. A second reason is the lack of any dedication to Yahweh, the God of Israel. This inscription was made at a time when Baal worship permeated Phoenician society and when the Red Sea port of Ezion Geber was functioning. This argues for a date well after the time of King Solomon. Ezion Geber was in the territory of Judah, and Judah was not an ally of the Sidonians. So this fact argues that Sidonians could only launch fleets from Ezion Geber after the fall of Judah, circa 586 BC. And we'll talk about the human sacrifice and the paganism of the Phoenicians when we get to looking at Carthage. Mm-hmm. The South American inscription makes no mention of any Israelites. During the Israelite portion of the Phoenician Golden Age, Israel, Tyre and Sidon mingled their naval crews together, which we read about in 1 Kings chapter 9, 26-27. So this inscription apparently was made after the Israelites had departed the region and were no longer in the Phoenician alliance. Dr. Kyrus Gordon's dating agrees with the above historical context. He asserts that this inscription was made in 534 BC during the reign of King Hiram III, a vassal of the Achaemenid Persian kings. Why did these Sidonians take a circuitous route around Africa to Brazil when a direct route through Gibraltar was the quickest way? Dr. Gordon answers, Gibraltar was controlled by the Carthaginian rivals of Cyrus the Great. The historical setting explains why the Sidonian fleet sailed from Ezion-Geba, taking the long but open route to the Atlantic. The Phoenicians' large colony, Carthage, had grown powerful and could bar Persian fleets from the Atlantic Ocean. Sidon was under Persian rule and therefore had to do the bidding of the Persian king. The Sidonians were likely looking for raw materials in the Atlantic regions, relying on their old records that such raw materials were exported from the New World in King Solomon's time. Indeed, the Phoenician inscription calls the land of ancient Brazil the Island of Iron. Dr. Gordon makes a good case that the ancient Phoenicians even called Brazil by its modern name. He writes that the Hebrew word for iron is Brazil, and that iron ore is one of Brazil's main resources. No country in the world merits the name Brazil or iron more than Brazil, whose chief resource is still iron. Indeed, it is reported that 25% of the world's known iron reserves are in the Brazilian province of Minas Gerais. Other parts of Brazil are also rich in iron. The Sidonian fleet serving Persia may have been looking for a way to exploit New World iron ore without the knowledge of the Carthaginians, who guarded access to the Atlantic Ocean by controlling Gibraltar. The above argues that the modern nation of Brazil still bears its Hebrew name, given to it by the ancient Phoenicians. This raises the likelihood that even as the Lake Superior copper mines were exploited around 1000 BC by King David's Israelites, the mariners of Kings David and Solomon found a source for iron ore in ancient Brazil. That is why Sidonian mariners arriving in South America still called the region by the name of Brazil when they landed there in 531 BC. Dr. Gordon dismisses the idea that these Sidonians arrived in the New World by accident. He writes, the crossing was probably not an accident. The winds and currents are all in favour of east to west crossings at that latitude, where the Atlantic happens to be much narrower than it is in the Northern Hemisphere. There is every reason to believe that the ship that reached Brazil in 531 BC sailed intentionally to a land already known by its name, the Island of Iron, to get raw materials. Phoenicia's most prominent ruler, King Solomon, wrote about the very trade winds that Dr. Gordon mentions. In Ecclesiastes 1:6, Solomon wrote, "The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns." This is exactly what the circular trade winds do over the oceans, and Solomon's awareness of this fact affirms that the Phoenicians knew about the oceanic trade winds 5 centuries before Sidonian sailors landed in Brazil in 531 BC. The Phoenicians, capitalists who knew the truth of the adage, time is money, no doubt used the trade winds to their commercial advantage by routing their ships to take advantage of the trade winds in their voyages across the Atlantic Ocean in either direction. There is further evidence of the presence of ancient Phoenicians or Israelites in South America. Dr. Gordon notes the widespread presence of the word para on South American rivers from Venezuela to Argentina. Paragua, Para, Paraniba, Paraiba, Paraguaca, etc. Two nations of South America still bear this same root word, Paraguay and Peru. He writes that this word root indicates that these rivers were named by people whose linguistic roots were from Mesopotamia, where Shemitic languages were spoken, and he specifically cites the Hebrew parat, or with a suffix T at the end there. This presents an intriguing possibility. If the Hebrew word parat is the origin of the South American word para, we have a form of the Hebrew word for covenant, which is berit. Dr. Gordon notes the language of the Aztecs did not distinguish between the letters P and B. As long ago as 1676 AD, Aylett Sams wrote that the letters P and B were easily convertible in ancient Phoenician place names. This would make Dr. Gordon's suggested root word of parat another form of the word berit or brat. The fact that the national name Brazil preserves the Hebrew word for iron argues for a Hebrew Semitic origin also of the para words, naming many rivers along Brazil's Atlantic coast. This leads to another possible explanation for an ancient mystery. Dr. Gordon discusses the ancient Piri Reis map found in Turkey in 1929. This map includes a strikingly accurate depiction of Brazil's South American coastline, noting many of its rivers. Dr. Gordon describes this amazing ancient map in these words. The principal map was painted in 1513 by the Turkish admiral Piri. Piri Reis tells us in his writings that the map embodies ancient sources, some of which came via the Great Library at Alexandria, which was destroyed by fire in the 17th century AD. There are features of the map that must antedate Columbus's discovery of America in 1492. Notably, the essentially correct east coastline of South America in its right longitudinal relationship with the Atlantic coast of the Old World. The computation of longitude at sea was not rediscovered in the modern world until the 18th century, yet the Piri Reis map confirms an ancient culture knew how to make longitudinally correct maps of continents and sea coasts. It is this author's conclusion that the original map from which the Piri Reis map was copied had to have been made by the ancient world's navigational experts, the Phoenicians. When Israel, Tyre, and Sidon fell or lost their independence, Carthage carried on their seafaring skills for centuries. The Piri Reis map is likely a copy of an ancient Carthaginian Phoenician map that was preserved in the Great Library at Alexandria. This is supported by the fact that A, the South American seacoast, so accurately depicted on the map, still bears a Hebrew name, Brazil, and B, its rivers are known by an old world root word from the Mesopotamian tradition, according to Dr. Gordon. The Israelites even founded colonies in the Black Sea region of Asia during their Golden Age. Herbert Hannay, a British historian, wrote about the other Hebrew colony in the Caucasus called Iberia, which was founded in the Hebrew-Phoenician era. We will examine more information about the Israelite kingdom called Iberia in a later section in this series. The Israelites in their Phoenician glory days founded colonies named Iberia, honouring their forefather Eber, in both ancient Spain and in the Caucasus region of Asia, east of the Black Sea. And I'll just point out, we also have the Hebrides, which also has Eber in the word. In Genesis 28:4, Abraham was promised that his birthright seed would spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. This prophecy was being fulfilled as the Israelites expanded all over the globe during Israel's golden age of the Phoenician Empire. The Phoenician alliance of Israel, Tyre, and Sidon founded numerous colonies in the Mediterranean region, Spain, the British Isles, and in ancient North and South America during the reigns of Kings David and Solomon around 1000 BC. Under these kings, the Israelite Empire began to plant colonies and to export Hebrew Phoenician culture around the world. The evidence that the ancient Israelites founded a large empire has been in the Bible for thousands of years, but there is now archaeological evidence which confirms that the biblical accounts were correct all along. At its zenith, the Phoenician Empire of Israel ruled portions of five continents: Asia, Africa, Europe, North America, and South America. Close quote. So quite a lot there to get into. But I mean, it was a much bigger empire than most people are taught about today. In fact, most people don't know very much about the Phoenician Empire at all. But it's, you know, it's written about in the Bible. It was the Israelites. And then there's these proofs of it with the language that was actually being used, found in these grave goods in America and even in the word for Brazil. I mean, that map is quite incredible, to have a map that draws the coastline perfectly in alignment with the coastline of the Old World as well, before we understood about latitude and longitude in the 18th century.
Yeah, well, obviously it must have been created by someone that had extensive knowledge on the subject. So it was probably, by people that, like, well, the logical conclusion would be people like the Phoenicians, wouldn't it?
Had to be tied
to those.
Had to be. And also, you know, it's how important the mining was. And where we talked about Cornwall and how important that was with the tin. And then you've also got copper that was needed. Where are they going to get copper from? Well, you know, 25% of the copper is there in Brazil. And it's still called by the iron, rather. That's what it was talking about, wasn't it? Iron, right?
Iron.
Yeah, and Brazil is still known by that word today. this Hebrew word for iron.
Yeah. So I wonder what would have happened then, because America or the South Americas weren't highly populated, were they? Maybe I'm just trying to think. I mean, there probably would have been some settlers, but at some point there would have been a disconnect as well, right?
Yeah, that's what he was saying there. What happened was the Phoenician part ended, got taken over by the Persians. And then you had the Punic part, which was Carthage, and they wouldn't allow the Persians to go through the Pillars of Hercules. They kept that bit cut off from the rest. And this is before the age of the Greeks, before the age of the Athenians. And they wouldn't actually allow these other peoples to get out of the Mediterranean. So they had to go around by another route. Basically, but around the south of Africa, I guess is what he's pointing out there. And if you've got these two groups that are at war, then they're not going to be able to afford to send off these great expeditions all the way to America to pick up these resources, and they're going to end up getting cut off, or they're going to end up having to come back to the homeland if they had enough resources to actually do that.
Yeah, it seems like there was obviously some connection, and then some initial migration, and then after the wars, it forced a kind of a halt in terms of trade, perhaps, and and travel and exploring, and then there was a time of there must have been some centuries prior to who was it? Columbus, who apparently discovered the Americas. I mean, for them to be kind of quite absent-minded of this past, there must have been a few centuries at least, where they'd forgotten about these trade routes.
Well, I think what you had the Phoenicians going over there, and then you had the wars putting a stop to that, and then you had Celts going over there at some point, which must have been after that. And then you had Vikings, and then you had Columbus. So people must have known, if you keep going in that direction, that there's land there, but there isn't any civilization there, and there's resources. And that's why we find the evidence of it. We find the evidence of this writing. So that's some alternative researchers there. I've also got some information from Wikipedia about all of this, and this is basically like a timeline of the Phoenicians. The first known account of the Phoenicians relates to the conquests of Pharaoh Thutmosis III in 1425 BC. By the mid-14th century, the Phoenician city-states were considered favoured cities to the Egyptians. Tyre, Sidon, Beirut, and Byblos were regarded as the most important. The Phoenicians had considerable autonomy, and their cities were reasonably well developed and prosperous. Byblos was the leading city. It was a centre for bronze making and the primary terminus of precious goods such as tin from Cornwall and lapis lazuli from as far east as Afghanistan. Sidon and Tyre also commanded interest among Egyptian officials, beginning a pattern of rivalry that would span the next millennium. And this was sort of after the time that the Assyrians would have made their connection with Britain, and they were getting the tin from there. But this still wasn't the time of the Phoenician Empire. This is just before it. And then we get the Imana letters reporting that from 1350 to 1300 BC, neighbouring Amorites and Hittites, who, as we know, were actually Israelites invading from the lands of the Amorites and the Hittites, we did an episode on this, they were capturing the Phoenician cities, especially in the north, and Egypt subsequently lost its coastal holdings from Ugarit in northern Syria to Byblos near central Lebanon. So until Joshua went in there, these Phoenicians, they were underlings to Egypt, basically. They weren't a civilization in their own right. And they worked for Egypt, basically, until Joshua went in there and kicked them out and replaced them. sometime between 1200 and 1150 BC, the Late Bronze Age collapse severely weakened or destroyed most civilizations in the region, including the Egyptians and the Hittites, providing the Israelites with a power vacuum where they then appeared in history as the Phoenicians, emerging as a distinct and organized civilization by 1230 BC. The period is sometimes described as a Phoenician Renaissance. They filled the power vacuum caused by the Late Bronze Age collapse by becoming the sole mercantile and maritime power in the region, a status they would maintain for the next several centuries. So you had the, this was just after you had the plagues of Egypt, and then you had the pharaohs after that, and he sort of managed to gain some strength again, and he had these Phoenician cities and Canaan that was under him. And then Joshua went in and attacked these Canaanites that were in Phoenicia and in Canaan and drove them out. And the Pharaoh didn't come to their rescue. That's what these Imana letters are saying. They're begging the Pharaoh to come. He didn't come to their rescue. And the Hittites, who are another Canaanite tribe, they lost out. They were destroyed. And Egypt was weakened. And then you had the Empire of Israel in its heyday. And what the Bible tells us, it all ties in with this time period, as we've talked about before, where we went into detail with it. Early into the Iron Age, the Phoenicians established ports, warehouses, markets, and settlements all across the Mediterranean and up to the southern Black Sea. Colonies were established on Cyprus, Sardinia, the Balearic Islands, Sicily, and Malta, as well as the coasts of North Africa and the Iberian Peninsula. Phoenician hack silver dated to this period bears lead isotope ratios matching ores in Sardinia and Spain, indicating the extent of the Phoenician trade networks. And we also have the tin that was found in modern-day Israel that also shows that it was originally from Cornwall. By the 10th century BC, Tyre rose to become the richest and most powerful Phoenician city-state, particularly during the reign of Hiram I. During the rule of the priest Ithabal, which is about 100 years later, Tyre expanded its territory as far north as Beirut and into part of Cyprus. This unusual act of aggression was the closest the Phoenicians ever came to forming a unitary territorial state. So as I was saying, that they remained these separate city-states. That's why they weren't all known as Israelites, because you had the Tyrians, the Sidonians, the Carthaginians, although they were all the same people, basically. Once his realm reached its largest territorial extent, Ithabal declared himself the King of the Sidonians, a title that would be used by his successors and mentioned in both Greek and Israelite accounts. The late Iron Age saw the height of Phoenician shipping, mercantile and cultural activity, particularly between 750 and 650 BC. The Phoenician influence was visible in the orientalization of Greek cultural and artistic conventions. Amongst their most popular goods were fine textiles, typically dyed with Tyrian purple. Homer's Iliad, which was composed during this period, references the quality of Phoenician clothing and metal goods. And we'll talk a bit about Homer's Iliad and the references to Phoenicia and what was happening with these Phoenician kings in the next episode. But so it would have been around about this time, 750 and 650 BC, when the Phoenicia was at its height. And from then on, it went downhill and it was taken over by the Persians. And that's when the traveling to America, North or South America, to do the mines, that's when it would have stopped for the Phoenicians, because the Carthaginians wouldn't allow them out, basically.
So it would have been the Assyrians then that came in.
The Assyrians, they were next door to the Persians, weren't they, the Assyrians?
Yeah. So from a similar area, similar empire.
Yeah, what you had, I think the Assyrians were taken over by the Persians, weren't they?
Because the Assyrians trying to time it for the Assyrian deportations of northern Israel.
That was about 750, and then the later one was the Persian deportation of Judah, and I think that was around about 650.
Right. So around about the same time, though, when they was at the height, compared to when they started to decline.
Yeah,
so, obviously,
just after the height is when it all fell apart, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
With the Israelites being removed from where they were. But then we're used to thinking of the Israelites as just actually being in that little strip that's called Israel. And, of course, they weren't.
Yeah.
They were the Sidonians. They were the Tyrenians. They were in Byblos as well. They were in all of those areas. But there were also Canaanites among them, because although originally they removed all the Canaanites from the land, some of them allowed to stay as slaves. And you ended up with this corruption. Solomon ended up with lots of different foreign wives. And he would have worshipped the foreign gods. And really, within, I guess, 100 years, 150 years, the Israelites were starting to engage in paganism and the sort of practices that the Canaanite tribes were involved in. And when we get into the origins of Carthage, we'll see what happened with that, which we will get into next week, I think. Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we finish, Patriarch?
No, I'm good with that.
Okay, well, I think we'll finish here then. So thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, as always.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.